Larry, let's start with two comments coming from two important countries right now in Europe, Serbia and Hungary. The head of Serbia, he said that we are going to have a world war in 3 to 4 months.
Yeah.
And the other one was from Orban. He's saying that NATO is preparing for a military operation in Ukraine, and we are not going to be part of this. What they're talking about when you look at these two pictures coming from these two countries that are important, that are opposing the NATO's policy in Ukraine?
Well, up to this point, NATO's doing a good job of threatening and exercising belligerent, you know, bellicose rhetoric. They're not able to really back it up entirely. So I would be more concerned if we saw an alert go out across Europe, activating each country's military force, putting them on alert, issuing them what's called a warning order that they be prepared to deploy to carry out a mission against Russia. We're not seeing that. And it's one thing for a leader to say, oh, we're going to respond militarily, we're going to send troops. Okay, start the process, because to activate these units, there's got to be communication from the chain of command, from the commander in chief, from the political decision maker, down to those guys, to get them to come together, you know, call people back who are on leave, get people out of training courses, have them assemble their equipment, and then, you know, give them the order to deploy. And so deploy from where to where? And if they're going to go, let's say, from France to a border post in Romania, okay, how are they going to get there? Are they going to go by car, truck, train? They're going to walk? They're going to go, you know, parachute in? You know, they've got to figure that out. So what we're seeing is this, you know, tough talk, but it's not being backed up yet by those kinds of tangible actions that you would expect to see if NATO was going to get involved full up with its troops on the ground. The, you know, in the United States, the process has this acronym, TPFL-DD, I think it is. It's called TIPFIDL. And so TIPFIDL is basically a time-phased process for which troops are activated and then forward deployed. And like in the case leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, that TIPFIDL process took about a year. So it started, you know, 12 months out. NATO is also, you know, threatening to supply, you know, more Storm Shadow, ATACMS. Germany's been sort of vacillating about whether to supply the Taurus or not. And yeah, again, here we get again this tough rhetoric. Oh, we're going to do this, and we're going to, yeah, and they're sending some. But neither the U.S. nor the Brits nor the French are sitting on a big pile of big stockpile of reserves. In fact, they've been rapidly using up their stockpiles to the point that many military officers in all three countries are expressing concern that, hey, you've given away so much, we don't have anything left for ourselves. So, like, you've got to slow down, stop passing it out. And what arrives in the hands of the Ukrainians, they fire it off. Well, there's not a ready resupply. So, yeah, they can fire a bunch of ATACMS at Crimea, and, you know, the vast majority of them get shot down. So, you know, they might as well go out and shoot them into the dirt themselves. It's not going to make a bit of difference tactically or strategically with respect to Russian forces and Russian actions. So, yes, the rhetoric is such that I understand why President Vucic and Serbia and Orban, the prime minister in Hungary, are concerned, because they say, you know, this is crazy talk. These people are trying to get us killed. the only good news in that is there's still limits to what they can accomplish. And remember, Stoltenberg, who's, you know, talking, you know, the Secretary General of the UN, I mean, of NATO, who's been big on, oh, we got to ramp up to do X, Y, and Z. He's still bitching at several of the NATO countries who promised to provide support to Ukraine, but didn't pony up. You know, there's still, oh, yeah, we'll kick in. Well, you can count on our $50,000. They come around to collect it. Oh, that seemed to be a little short right now. Get back to me next week. That's what's going on with them.
Larry, Stoltenberg is talking about decades of conflict in Ukraine. Do you think they want to make the conflict in Ukraine as we saw in Afghanistan, in Iraq?
Russia's not stupid enough to get involved with something like that. They're going to put a quick end to this one of these days. I think they're content right now to attrit the Ukrainians, and that attrition process has been accelerating, not decelerating. You know, last year the Ukrainians were suffering around 600-700 casualties per day. Now it's triple that. It's around 2,000. You can't keep that pace up. I mean, that's basically a brigade per day. So over the course of 2 weeks, that's 14 brigades gone. That's 28,000 men gone. Keep that up for another 2 weeks at that same pace, that's 48,000 gone. Ukraine's not sitting on some unlimited supply of men, and they don't have trained men. That's the problem. And you don't, there's no shortcut to get around that fact. Training requires time. You know, if I'm going to train you to shoot a semi-automatic pistol, you're going to have to spend a minimum of 6 hours with me to learn how to do it properly. Some of that's going to be work inside a classroom. Some of that's going to be work out on the range. But a minimum of 6 hours. And there's no way that you can, if you have no experience, there's no way to shortcut it. If you have experience, yeah, we can eliminate some phases. But that's not, you know, all the guys with the experience and training, they're either in the army or they're dead or wounded.
Do you think that they're going to send F-16s? They're talking every time they're talking about F-16s. Is Ukraine going to get these fighters or not, in your opinion?
I think probably. And they're going to get them, and Russia's going to destroy them.
And they're going to put it inside Ukraine or outside?
No. They're going to have to be based in Romania, which if they land in Romania and then they take off from Romania, fly into Ukraine and start hitting Russian forces, then the Russians will hit those Romanian air bases and destroy those planes. That simple. And you know, at that point, Romania's got to decide, is it going to declare Article 5 and go to war with Russia? Because even if they, quote, activate Article 5, every other country's legislators got to go, yeah, we want to fight Russia too. Yeah, I can see the Italians going, oh, you know, not, this is not tutto bene. You know, it's not all good. Let's wait. And, you know, I see particularly Germany. Germans would be most reluctant to get involved. So all of a sudden, yeah, let's everybody, come on, guys. And they're running forward and they look back and nobody's behind them. And then they're going, uh-oh. So that's, I think the prospects for all NATO countries signing on to that is remote. But and that's one of the things you're going to have to factor. One of the reasons they're not going to deploy the F-16s into Ukraine, the runways basically have to be pristine. I mean, free of debris, no crap blowing across it, no rocks, no. And, you know, they've got to take time to make sure that that's cleaned up. Well, you can't guarantee that in Ukraine right now. And if they land and have initially a pristine airfield, you can be sure Russia is going to be peppering it with some cluster bombs, cluster munitions. which are going to put pitting and little concave spots throughout the runway. That'll make it difficult for the plane to operate. So I don't see that being based there.
Norwegian Prime Minister is talking about Norway, Sweden, and Finland have agreed to create a military transport corridor through the northern part of their territories. First of all, two questions when it comes to this type of declaration, this type of mindset. Why, if they're doing this, why they're talking about it? If it is something important. The second question would be, why would they need this corridor if they don't want to confront Russia?
Yeah, no, what they're creating is a causus belli. They're creating, you know, up to this point, Russia didn't have to worry about them creating a potential military threat on their border. Now they do. And add to that the fact that Sweden on Tuesday, I believe it was, the 18th, launched, their parliament approved this joint agreement with the United States that basically opens up 17 bases in Sweden to U.S. nuclear weapons. You know, but they're out of their damn minds. That is, if they go forward with that, if the United States actually decides to deploy some nukes there, they've created the equivalent for Russia of a Cuban Missile Crisis. This would be Cuban Missile Crisis 2.0. And in the same way as the United States was prepared to go to war with Cuba over destroying those weapons, Russia likely hit Sweden. It's not going to sit back and wait to see if the West decides to actually use the weapons once they forward deployed them.
Yeah. How did you find Putin's trip to North Korea? He went there. He was amazingly welcome in North Korea. It's unbelievable how they... And when it comes to the objectives of this trip, this visit to North Korea, there are two concepts. First of all, he wants to just connect the military-industrial complex of Russia to that one of North Korea. We know that they're so, in terms of artillery shells, they're so good right now. And the other thing would be just giving an economic relief to North Korea that they need desperately.
Yeah.
And the other point would be sending some signals to the South Korea, just let them know, if you want to send weapons to Ukraine, supporting Ukraine, we're going to respond to you. After all, how did you find this trip?
Yeah, no, I think Putin was doing what we call horizontal escalation. So instead of going up, he's going out. So strengthening a military alliance, a genuine military alliance with North Korea, because it's right on Russia's border, and they're going to agree to cooperate militarily. Sending a message to both South Korea, Japan, and the United States that Russia will ensure that North Korea is in a position that it can respond or take action that will be detrimental to those other three countries. North Korea stands as a sort of another symbolic failure of U.S. foreign policy. Note that when Trump was president, he at least made a good faith effort to try to forge a relationship with Kim Jong-un. And I think he initially succeeded in that, but it certainly didn't have support back here in the United States. We prefer to have this antagonism with North Korea. Note that the United States policy of imposing sanctions on countries in order to what? Force a change in government and or force a change in that government's policy. These sanctions have been utter failures. Yeah, they've inflicted some pain and suffering on the people of North Korea, and the people of Iran and the people of Cuba, among others. It failed to inflict pain and suffering on the people of Russia. It sort of, all that did is it woke them up saying, you know, like a Neo from Matrix, you know, oh my God, what is, you're seeing the whole Matrix now. Oh, this, what, the West is corrupt. They're evil. They're bad. So we're not going to follow them anymore. So here's Russia taking the lead now that, you know, it restarts, expands its relationships with China. So, you know, China and Russia are in hand in hand. China's always had sort of a, let's call it a love-hate relationship with North Korea. You know, they have been sort of like that big brother that has to always weigh in with the younger brother to keep him from getting drunk and going out and crashing the car on Saturday night. And, you know, the North Koreans are a little resentful of that. But the Chinese want to make sure that they don't go out and do something crazy. But I wouldn't be surprised out of Putin's trip now, that, because understand, they signed some agreements. Well, this trip, there had been Russian diplomats and North Korean diplomats traveling back and forth between Pyongyang and Moscow for at least the last 6 months, working on these agreements, working on the language, working on the translations, making sure everybody understood what they meant when they said certain words and phrases. So when Putin shows up with Kim Jong-un to sign those agreements, this, you know, this reflects a lot of prior work that had taken place. And so it shows that this is not some, you know, Putin didn't just wake up last week and go, damn, I think I'm going to make me a trip to North Korea and I'm going to piss off those Americans. No, this had been planned. It was in, you know, the Russians are really good at strategic planning and thinking ahead. And so it was surely coordinated with Lavrov, surely coordinated with the defense ministry. It probably started under Shoigu, to be honest. So that's, you know, that's one of the real implications of this visit, that Putin's signaling, you know, and they had thought about it for a while, that, you know, we're going to be with, you know, North Korea is not alone. We got their back. The other element is the level of military cooperation. Now, the West keeps insisting that, oh my God, if were it not for North Korea and China, Russia would be beaten. They just couldn't, you know, survive. That's a bunch of crap. But what it does do is Russia allows North Korea to come in and test its weapons in combat. Yeah, you get to see how they work. You know, get to try it out. And they can make technical adjustments as needed. Korea also has an ample supply of labor that if they go to work in Russian factories, it's going to do two things. It's going to bring currency back into North Korea from Russia, so it will enrich the country and it will boost their economy. So, you know, this was, from Putin's standpoint, a win-win, as well as from Kim Jong-un. And if anything, it probably gives Russia more control, or at least it's in a position to better influence the North Korean government.
Yeah, what's the importance of Vietnam to Russia, in your opinion? He went to Vietnam right after the trip to North Korea. And we saw that how they were welcoming him, and the way it was amazing as well. But
yeah, well, it'd be like welcoming Putin is like welcoming Lafayette if he came back to the young United States in the 1830s for a visit. You know, he would have been an extremely old man. Maybe he's dead by then. But the point was, here comes the guy who was instrumental in getting French support against the Americans in the American Revolution. Well, Putin, you know, Russia, it wasn't Putin. It was Brezhnev. It was Andropov. Gromyko, you know, the old guys back in the 1960s played a critical role in supplying weapons and armaments to the North Vietnamese that they then used to kill American soldiers. And, you know, they killed 58,000, a little more, but they helped Vietnam win that war. And remember, prior to that war, there was a period where the Soviets had a had a naval base at Cam Ranh Bay. And then that sort of disappeared during the course of that war. I'm not sure they ever got it reestablished, but, you know, they very well could be looking at reestablishing that. So Vietnam is an economic, it's becoming a potent economic force in Southeast Asia, one that has to be paid attention to. And Russia was saying, hey, yeah, we need to pay attention to you too.
When you look at the summit in Switzerland, there are two comments coming from the president of Finland. He said that Russia invaded his country during the Second World War.
Yeah. I mean, they're at least Finland at the time was sympathetic to Nazi Germany, but you know, there had been this border dispute going on for a while between Russia and Finland, and Russia got the worst of that battle. They were unprepared to fight. It was in the winter, and the weather was bad, and you know, they ended up losing essentially to the Finns. But dredging up World War II, that, you know, that sort of shows how desperate the West is. Is that, and what's been amazing to me is that they lie. They so, you know, repeatedly lie about what occurred in World War II, and to the point of suggest, like the Canadians suggest, oh boy, these Ukrainians, man, they're fighting against the Soviets. Yeah, because they were wearing swastikas and they were aligned with the Nazi SS. Please, you know, just be honest about what you're doing.
Yeah. And the other comment was the president of Poland. He said that we have to decolonize Russia. Just breaking into federations, 200 federations. Unbelievable, yeah. What he's talking about. And this was supposed to be a peace summit. Then they're talking about peace, not talking about more conflict, more problems, making more problems within the conflict.
Well, note that Russia, in turn, was not talking about breaking up Poland into separate republics or doing that to any other of the NATO states. Simply, you know, his offer was pretty straightforward. He, you know, he should have started off saying, remember that offer we gave you 2 years ago, March, where we were willing to let you have Luhansk and Donetsk back in exchange for a pledge of neutrality? Screw that. We're keeping those, and we're going to take Kherson, and we're taking Zaporizhia with us as well. You get the hell out. Then we'll talk. NATO, oh, we're outraged. We're not going to talk to you. And Putin's fine. Okay, boys, take it. And they're going to continue to move and take control of those two pieces of the territory. Now, some have made, I know that some comments have emanated, I know with Pepe Escobar, for example, suggesting that there was some upset in Russia domestically, because Putin, when he made that announcement, didn't say anything about Kiev or Odessa. You know, saying that he probably should have clarified that. Well, I personally think that was deliberate, because he wasn't gonna put Odessa and Kiev on the table. By not even talking about them, he's leaving them off the table so that he can act if he chooses. So that's, you know, I think he fully anticipated the West to reject it. And he's going to go, okay, good. We'll press forward and we'll secure those territories on our own, and we'll kill a lot of Ukrainians in the process.
If the West continues to support Ukraine, if they decide not to negotiate with Russia, would be a death on Nikolaev, Dnipropetrovsk, and these cities. And in your opinion, if Russia goes to Kiev, if Russia captures Kiev, do they really need to go to the western part of Kiev, or the western part doesn't need, and it's gonna just collapse because there are various ethnicities in those parts?
Yeah.
Polish, Romania.
Yeah, I don't see, Russia's definitely not gonna go up to the Polish border and have to run the risk of pacifying some hostile territory, because there are a lot of there'll be a lot of angry Catholics and angry Poles, people with Polish heritage, people of Romanian heritage, even people of Hungarian heritage, that would, push back. And so I don't see Russia doing that, but they are very likely to definitely take control of Kiev and Odessa, because there is, Kiev is a Russian city. It was the birthplace of Christianity in Russia, with the Eastern Orthodox Church in 989, 998, somewhere in there. So it's, it's been around for a while as Russian territory. Similarly with Odessa. So I don't see Russia walking away from those, or Nikolaev. They're ultimately going to take them. The question remains, will they be taken peacefully, or will they slaughter a bunch of Ukrainian soldiers in the process? That's sort of up to Ukraine.
Shifting the discussion to the conflict in Gaza, mm-hmm. How do you see the current face of the conflict? We know that it seems that Netanyahu is desperately looking for some sort of escalations between Israel and Hezbollah. And before going to the United States, he started attacking Biden. Do you think that he's looking for some sort of permission from the United States to attack Hezbollah when he gets back?
No. I think if anything, he's, he's getting advice from the United States, at least being reported in the media, to say, don't do it. Don't attack Lebanon. Don't attack Hezbollah. Don't do it. You're going to get your ass handed to you. What happened this week was a dangerous shift in Israel. The resignation of the opposition political opponents to Netanyahu from the war cabinet is now made Israel more likely to go forward with these reckless operations in southern Lebanon. Not less likely, because before, the war cabinet under the Israeli, let's call it their constitution, the way it's constructed, that war cabinet was the commander in chief, not just Netanyahu. So all members of that cabinet had a say. And that's why, when they switched it from the war cabinet, they resigned. Well, it now reverts to the regular cabinet. Well, you got all the crazies there. You got Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Those two alone are complete nutcases. And, they're going to press Netanyahu to go into southern Lebanon. And Netanyahu's talking that up. And notice this rift that had developed this week when the head of the Israeli occupation force, the one general, came out and said, well, we can't defeat Hamas, because Hamas is an idea. You can't defeat an idea. And Netanyahu pushed back on that hard. And I'm sure he's got some support in the United States on that. But the Israeli general is right. We'll see how much of a conflict, if any, there is between Netanyahu and the IDF going forward. Could be the IDF would say, hey, we're not fighting. And then they'd be faced with having to do court martials and create complete chaos in Israel. So this thing can go a lot of different directions. If the military cooperates and backs up Netanyahu, then they're going to go to war in Lebanon. And it's really increases chances that Israel is going to get decisively defeated militarily. It could put the country at the very existence of Israel as a nation at risk. If they don't go in, you're still likely to get some major political chaos as the pro-Netanyahu crowd and the anti-Netanyahu crowd start increasingly turning on each other. And then, you know, get your popcorn out. There's going to be a fight. You know, it's like back in grade school, fight, fight, you know. They're squaring off and brawling. That's where we're headed.
Why does he need to attack Hezbollah? He was just complaining about the Biden administration not sending enough weapons to Israel. He just mentioned Iran. We are fighting Iran. We are doing this. We are doing that. And when it comes to this type of rhetoric, why he's mentioning Iran when Iran is not actively participating in the conflict?
Yeah, Iran has a close relationship with Hezbollah, and Iran has supplied Hezbollah with some critical weapon systems. But Hezbollah is still sort of its own animal, too. That's what people don't appreciate. They're not this puppet at the end of a string that Iran's pulling, and they, you know, gladly hop around and dance. Hamas is its own person. Hamas has basically forced at least well over 100,000, if not more, Israelis, settlers who were inhabited in swaths of North Israel to abandon home and head south, go to hotels, find some place to hide out so they're not getting shelled. Because Hamas has been able to shell a lot of these settlements and set them on fire, set fields on fire, attacked military installations, attacked military observation posts. So Hezbollah has been quite active, and Israel hasn't been able to stop them. And Hezbollah is a real problem for Israel, unlike Hamas. You know, with the Israelis, they're killing women, children, and guys that basically are not trained to fight. Oh, look at the big, tough Israelis. Ooh. Yeah, they're engaged with genocide. They're killing the unarmed, the people who can't defend themselves. They're persecuting the weak. Hezbollah is not weak. Hezbollah is estimated at least 100,000-man army. Talking army now. We're not talking you guys that wear a headband and show up on weekends to chant. Okay, we're talking guys that have been actually deployed into Syria, that have fought against Syrian rebels and members of ISIS. And we're talking about, you know, they're well equipped, they're dug in, they got underground tunnels, trenches, you know. It's more formidable, depending on how you like to pronounce it, than anything Hamas had.
When you look at two different attitudes from Russia and Israel, when you compare these two countries, they are fighting, they are leading with a conflict in the region.
Yeah.
You see, every time Putin is putting out, this is the fourth time he's putting out a peace proposal to negotiate. And you see, on the other hand, you see Netanyahu suggesting nothing but the continuation of the war.
Right.
If Israel is winning, if Israel is just achieving its objectives in Gaza, why they're not suggesting any sort of peace plan to end this conflict?
Because they want to exterminate the Palestinians. That's what they're after. They don't want to leave a single Palestinian in Gaza. They want Gaza for themselves. They want to build beachfront, you know, as we saw Jared Kushner Trump's son-in-law. Oh, we're going to build beachfront hotels and restaurants and condos and, you know, big real estate development. But what about the people who live there? Screw them. Let them die, force them out, send them to Egypt. We don't care. Just get them the hell out of Gaza. It's no longer their territory. That's what the Israelis are doing.
Do you think that when this conflict started, they thought that Egypt gonna just open the border and let all these Gazans just going there and just that then close the border and not letting them back? And this was the plan. It seems to me that has failed. That has already failed. That they couldn't do that.
Yeah. That was their hope. The United States, I mean, they apparently offered to Egypt. You know, they're like that TV show here in the United States. Let's make a deal. Hey, we're going to forgive your debt, forgive all your debt, and we'll give you these new weapon systems. And hey, we're going to give you a little bit of additional money if you will let the Palestinians come live in Egypt. Egypt went, nah, I don't think so. Not good enough. We're not going to do it. Yeah, so that's part of the problem. They don't have anywhere to send the Palestinians unless the Israelis kill them all. And Israel is quite happy to keep killing them. They don't care. They view, I can show you messages. I haven't confirmed if it's really from the defense minister, Gallant, or if it's just made up, but it basically talks about wiping out all the Palestinians, kill the women, kill the children, kill the babies, because they represent a threat for the future. Destroy the future of the Palestinians. Let's say there was a period when the United States was like a beautiful woman, very attractive, cultured, somebody you'd fun to be with. You know, hey, you've got the best music and the best clothes, got really great food that's going to cause diabetes, but what the heck, you know, eat those McDonald's burgers. And the problem now is, here we are, you know, so that's that young woman in her 20s, you know, just knock out gorgeous. Okay, 40 years later, the problem is the United States still thinks it's that the young woman, beautiful young woman. But, you know, the United States has put on 60 pounds. We're ugly. We got skin rashes. And we're nasty, downright nasty. We're abusive to other people. We're insulting to other people. We get into fights with other people. And then we wonder, God, why don't they like us? You know? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with your tendency to try to start a war or impose sanctions upon somebody every time they don't do what you want them to do. And I keep returning to that issue of sanctions as far as how stupid it's been on the part of the United States. You would think a policymaker would go to the CIA and say, hey, give me a study. Show me the instances in history where sanctions have worked. And what's the definition of worked? Well, the definition of worked or effective is it forced a government to change its policy, or it led to the ouster of that government and its replacement with one friendly to us and our needs. How's that worked out? Well, Cuba, still there. They got a new president, younger, taller, probably better looking than Fidel, more energetic. Then how about Iran? Iran's economy is starting to grow. And even with the death of President Raisi and his foreign minister, they're on the road for a new election, and their relationships with Russia and China are giving them an out that they're no longer trapped economically. Talked about North Korea, again, a pariah state that nobody's supposed to deal with, but Russia's going to say, oh, we'll deal with you. And, you know, banks, it's going to open up some economic opportunities for North Korea. So the point is here with all these sanctions, the West isn't accomplishing anything other than convincing other people. The United States is dangerous. They're your enemy, not your friend. When you lose that kind of ability to exercise diplomacy, you're in trouble.
Yeah, if Turkey joins BRICS, that would hugely pave the path for Serbia and Hungary to join BRICS, because they would say, Turkey is part of NATO, that they're joining BRICS. Why not us? Why we can do that?
Well, again, yeah, when you're Turkey and when you're Hungary and Serbia, you reach a point where you say, why are we a member of a club where they treat us like crap, where they insult us, where they bully us, where they threaten us with sanctions? Why did we put up with that? You know, just make it, put it into your, how you would act in your own personal life if, you know, if you had an abusive friend that was, you know, stealing from you and, you know, hitting you and insulting you in public. And, you know, after a while you go, I don't want to even be around that person. Keep them away from me. That's what the United States has been achieving with its diplomacy under Joe Biden.
And if you're, because we know that these countries are landlocked and they don't have access to the sea, and Russia can provide them with access to the Black Sea. That's,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
The future is so different, Larry. It's changing, and it's changing drastically.
Well, and what's driving the change is that the traditional controls we thought we had in place are no longer there.